A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a fun one. He's got a friend from New York who says Trump talks exactly like every old school guy he grew up with in Queens. Not an aberration, just a dialect. Daniel's question is, for those of us whose oratory feels a bit flat, how can we channel some of that Trump energy into our daily lives without, you know, the baggage? I love this framing because it treats the style as a set of tools, not a political stance.
That's exactly the right way into it. And it's worth stating up front. This episode is a communication analysis, not a political endorsement or a takedown. We're reverse engineering, a rhetorical style that is demonstrably effective at commanding attention. Linguists who've studied Trump's speeches find he uses superlatives at roughly 3 times the rate of typical political speakers. That's not an accident. That's a system.
So where the average politician might say, we have a strong economy, Trump says we have the greatest economy in the history of the world. Same basic claim, completely different register.
And that register has a specific origin story. Trump was born in Queens in 1946. He came up in a post-war New York where the tough guy persona was a recognized archetype. Directness, self-promotion, verbal sparring. These weren't personality quirks. They were survival skills in dense, competitive environments. If you couldn't project confidence and hold your ground in a conversation, you got steamrolled.
I've heard this from people who grew up in that era. The guy who runs the corner store, the contractor, the coach. They all talk in superlatives. Not because they're lying, but because understatement in that culture reads as weakness. If you say I do decent work, people hear I'm not confident in my work.
That's the core puzzle. This style gets mocked as crude or exaggerated, but it works. It commands attention. It projects confidence. So the question becomes, what are the actual linguistic mechanisms underneath it, and can you extract them without adopting the divisive content?
Think of it as learning the grammar, not the vocabulary.
So let's start by breaking down the specific moves.
Oh, the grammar of bombast. I'm in.
There are 3 main mechanisms that show up consistently. The first one linguists call the truth by repetition loop. You say something 3 times in slightly different ways. It's going to be huge. It's going to be tremendous. It's going to be like nothing you've ever seen. Each pass reinforces the core claim, but the slight variation makes it feel like you're building a case rather than just repeating yourself.
Even though you are just repeating yourself.
Well, not exactly. You are, but the variation disguises it. And this taps into something cognitive psychologists call the fluency heuristic. Statements that are easier to process, through repetition, simple structure, confident delivery, are rated as more truthful by listeners. Your brain mistakes processing ease for truth.
If I say this podcast is good, this podcast is tremendous, this podcast is the best podcast, enough times, people's brains start nodding along.
It's uncomfortable, but well documented. And here's the thing. This isn't some dark art discovered by political consultants. Advertisers have been doing it for a century. Snap, crackle, pop. Melts in your mouth, not in your hands. These phrases get drilled in through sheer repetition until they feel like objective facts. You don't evaluate the claim anymore. You just recognize the rhythm.
Jingles are basically the truth, by repetition loop set to music. And nobody accuses a serial jingle of being manipulative. We just accept that repetition works.
Because we understand the genre, which we'll come back to. The second mechanism is hyperbolic framing, turning any success, no matter how minor, into the definitive version of that thing. The biggest tax cut in history. The best jobs numbers anyone has ever seen. This isn't just exaggeration for its own sake, it's a strategic move that exploits the anchoring effect.
Tversky and Kahneman, 1974.
Look at you. The anchoring effect means that an initial extreme claim shifts subsequent judgments, even when the listener recognizes the claim is exaggerated. If I open with, "This is the most important episode we've ever recorded," you're going to listen more carefully, even if you know intellectually that I say that every week.
You do say that every week.
You're still here. That's the point. The anchor pulls the subsequent conversation toward it. If I'd opened with, this is a moderately interesting episode, your baseline for attention is much lower. The classic study on this, Tversky and Kahneman, had people estimate what percentage of African nations were in the UN. Before they answered, they spun a wheel that landed on either 10 or 65. The people who got 10 guessed around 25%. The people who got 65 guessed around 45%. A completely random number shifted their judgment by 20 points.
They knew the wheel was random. That's the wild part. The anchor works even when you know it's nonsense.
When Trump says, we've created the greatest economy in the history of the world, even if you think that's absurd, your brain has now been anchored to the idea that the economy is at least very good. You've shifted from evaluating whether things are good or bad to evaluating just how good they are. The frame has been set.
The third mechanism...
eliminating qualifiers entirely. No, I think, no, maybe, no, it seems like. Every statement lands as an established fact. We have the best economy, not, I believe we have a strong economy, not the indicators suggest growth, just the bare declarative.
This is the one that makes academics and journalists twitch, because their entire training is about adding qualifiers and caveats.
For good reason in their context. But in everyday communication, most people's speech is absolutely saturated with hedges. I sort of think maybe we should possibly consider, by the time you get to the verb, the listener has already tuned out.
I want to pause on this one because I think it's the hardest for people to actually implement. There's a social norm in a lot of workplaces, especially in the US outside of New York, where hedging is basically a politeness marker. You're signaling, I'm not imposing my view on you. I'm just offering it tentatively.
That norm has a real function. It reduces conflict. It leaves room for others to disagree without losing face. The problem is that it's become the default setting rather than a tool you deploy intentionally. When everything is hedged, nothing stands out. And worse, you start to sound like you don't believe your own words.
There's a great example of all three moves in a single sentence. We have the best economy in the history of the world. Absolute claim with no caveat. Check. And it's part of a repetition loop because he said versions of that line hundreds of times.
Now contrast that with a typical corporate statement. We are seeing strong economic indicators in the third quarter, a qualifier, indicators, rather than the economy, a time-bound hedge in the third quarter. It's technically more accurate and it's completely forgettable.
The corporate version is designed to be defensible. The Trump version is designed to be memorable. Those are different goals.
That's the trade-off. If your goal is to avoid being wrong on a technicality, you hedge. If your goal is to be heard and remembered, you declare.
We know what the techniques are and why they work cognitively. Now, the question Daniel's really asking, can we use them without the baggage?
This is where it gets interesting, because I think there's a usable core here that has nothing to do with politics or bombast. Let's start with declarative framing. The idea is simple. State your point as a fact, not an opinion. Not, I think we should go with option A, but option A is the right move. Not, I feel like the deadline is tight, but the deadline is tight.
That feels aggressive to a lot of people. They've been socialized to soften everything.
That socialization has a cost, particularly for people who are already underestimated in meetings. They soften their language, which makes them sound less confident, which makes them more underestimated. It's a loop.
Step one is just noticing how many hedges you use. Sort of, kind of, maybe, I think, I feel like, just, as in, I just wanted to check in.
Just is a killer. I just wanted to follow up. You're apologizing for existing in someone's inbox. Drop the just. I'm following up on this. Same information, completely different posture.
Step two is strategic repetition. Pick your key message and say it three ways. Not verbatim repetition. That sounds robotic, but a fact, a comparison, and a consequence. We ship 10,000 units. That's double last quarter. That means we're the market leader.
That's a great template. And notice how each version adds a layer. The fact establishes what happened. The comparison gives it context. The consequence tells you why you should care. By the third version, you've built a mini narrative.
You've done it without a single superlative. That's the thing. Repetition doesn't require hyperbole. You can repeat a modest claim, and it still lands harder than a single bold claim. I remember a manager I had years ago who did this instinctively. Every team meeting, he'd say the same core priority three different ways over the course of an hour. At first, I thought he was just forgetful. Then I realized I actually remembered what the priority was. I'd absorbed it without trying.
That's the fluency heuristic in action. He wasn't being forgetful. He was being strategic, whether he knew it or not. The third piece is what I'd call the superlative budget. Hyperbole is a tool, not a default setting. If everything is amazing and incredible, those words lose all meaning. But if you allow yourself one genuine superlative per conversation, saved for the thing that actually matters, it lands like a hammer.
This is the best candidate we've interviewed. If you say that about every candidate, it's noise. If you say it once a year, people pay attention.
This connects to something important about context. The New York tough guy style works brilliantly in certain settings. Sales, leadership, public speaking, any situation where projecting confidence is the primary goal. It backfires spectacularly in others. Sensitive conversations with a partner or colleague.
You're the best spouse in the history of marriages. Maybe not the move during an argument about who forgot to take out the trash.
The calibration matters. Which brings us to a case study that I think is instructive. He used the same best product ever framing, the same declarative certainty, the same repetition. But the delivery was different, more measured, more pauses, a different cultural register. And the credibility base was different. He was introducing actual products you could hold and evaluate.
Same grammar, different vocabulary, different context.
And audiences accepted the hyperbole because they understood the genre. A product launch is theater. Nobody expects the CEO to come out and say, "Our new phone is moderately better than the last one in several respects." Hyperbole is part of the ritual.
The same way a sports commentator can say, "That was the greatest play I've ever seen," and nobody fact-checks them. It's understood as emotional truth, not literal truth.
Which brings us to the ethical boundary. Hyperbole is fine when the audience knows it's hyperbole. It becomes manipulation when it distorts verifiable reality in ways that cause harm. This investment will definitely triple in value. That's not colorful language, that's fraud.
The line is, can a reasonable listener tell you're being hyperbolic? If yes, you're in rhetorical territory. If you're presenting false specifics as facts, you've crossed into deception.
This is where Trump's style becomes genuinely problematic in governance contexts. A product launch is theater. A pandemic briefing is not. Applying the same hyperbolic register to both creates real confusion about what's literal and what's rhetorical.
For the rest of us, giving a presentation or running a meeting or just trying to be heard in a noisy world, these techniques are useful. Let's make this concrete. Daniel specifically asked how to apply this to everyday life.
Here's a practical exercise. Take a flat sentence, something you might actually say at work. Our project is going well. Now apply the three techniques. Declarative framing, our project is on track to exceed targets. Strategic repetition, we're hitting milestones. We're ahead of schedule. We're delivering results. Then strip the hedges. No, I think it's going okay.
The difference between those two versions is night and day. The first one sounds like you're hoping things work out. The second sounds like you're in control.
Here's the thing. You haven't lied. You haven't exaggerated beyond what's true. You've just removed the verbal tics that undermine your own message.
What if the project isn't actually going that well? How do you use these techniques without becoming dishonest?
That's a crucial question. The techniques don't require you to claim success you haven't earned. Declarative framing works just as well for problems. We're behind schedule. We've identified the bottleneck. We need two additional engineers to hit the deadline. That's direct, unhedged, and honest. The confidence isn't in the outcome, it's in the clarity of the assessment.
It's not about pretending everything is great. It's about removing the verbal wobble that makes you sound like you're not sure about your own diagnosis.
Confidence and honesty are not in tension here. You could be direct about bad news. In fact, directness about bad news often builds more trust than hedged good news, because people can tell you're not managing them.
Daniel also asked about describing ordinary events in that style, and I think there's a fun exercise there. Take something mundane, making breakfast, walking the dog, a meeting that went fine, and describe it in full Trumpian register. Not because you'd ever do that seriously, but because it teaches you where the levers are.
I made the best omelet. Nobody makes omelets like me. The eggs were tremendous. The cheese, perfect. People are saying it's the greatest breakfast they've ever seen.
See, that's absurd. But you can feel the structure, the superlative, the repetition, the absolute certainty about something completely trivial. It's a warm-up exercise. Once you can do the exaggerated version, you can dial it back to something usable.
That dialing back is the whole game. The goal isn't to become a caricature. It's to find the volume knob and learn where your personal sweet spot is. For some people, cutting 50% of their hedges is enough. For others, they need to add some hedges back in because they've gone too far the other direction.
I've definitely met people who overcorrected on this. They read some blog post about speaking with authority, and suddenly they're making absolute pronouncements about where to get lunch. It's exhausting.
It fails for the same reason using superlatives on everything fails. If you're declarative about trivia, you've just trained people to ignore your declarative statements. Save the unhedged certainty for the moments that warrant it. For lunch, you can say, "I'd prefer Thai." You don't need to announce that Thai is the only correct choice.
Let's talk about the three things someone can actually try this week. I want actionable stuff here.
First one, the three-sentence rule. For any important point you make, deliver it three ways. A fact, a comparison, and a consequence. Practice this in low-stakes situations. First, a family dinner, a casual conversation. Get the rhythm down. Ezra finished his puzzle. He did it faster than yesterday. Kids developing some real spatial reasoning.
That's natural. It doesn't sound like a technique. It just sounds like someone making a complete point instead of a fragment.
Second, the hedge audit. Record yourself in one meeting or conversation, with permission, obviously. Circle every hedge word. Sort of, kind of, maybe, I think, I feel like, just actually, a little bit. Then aim to reduce by half in your next conversation.
Most people are going to be horrified by that count. I've done this. It's humbling.
It really is. I did it during my pediatric practice years and discovered I was hedging constantly with parents. I think the fever will probably break in a day or so when I actually knew exactly what was going to happen. The hedges weren't making me sound thoughtful. They were making me sound uncertain about things I was certain about.
In a medical context, that's actually a problem. Parents need clarity, not a cloud of maybes.
They came to me for an answer, and I was giving them a probability distribution wrapped in verbal cotton, when I switched to, the fever will break within 24 hours. Here's what to watch for in the meantime. The relief in the room was visible.
Third actionable thing?
The superlative budget. One genuine superlative per conversation. Save it for the thing that actually matters. If you use it on the coffee, you don't have it for the candidate you're recommending. The scarcity is what gives it weight.
I want to push on something here. A lot of people listening are going to think, this sounds like advice for men. The research on workplace communication shows that women who use declarative, unhedged language often get penalized for it in ways men don't.
That's a real and well-documented problem. The same behavior gets coded as confident in men and aggressive or abrasive in women. It's not fair, and is not something individual communication tweaks can fully solve.
What's the advice for someone who faces that double bind?
I think the calibration becomes even more important. The techniques still work, but the delivery matters enormously. Warmth plus certainty is a combination that tends to short-circuit the stereotype. I'm confident about this, and I'm excited to hear what you think. Declarative, but inviting. You're not softening the claim, you're softening the social frame around it.
It's not either be confident or be likable. It's finding ways to signal both.
And honestly, that's good advice for everyone. Pure Trump-style delivery. No warmth, no invitation, just declarative hammer blows works for rallies. It's exhausting in a meeting with six people. The research on this is pretty clear. Warmth and competence are the two dimensions people evaluate you on. And if you max out competent signals without any warm signals, you get respected but not trusted. You need both.
The warmth piece doesn't require hedging. You can say, here's what I think we should do, and I want to hear where you disagree. That's direct and open at the same time.
That's the sweet spot. Certainty about your own view, genuine curiosity about others. It's a harder balance to strike than either pure hedging or pure bombast, but it's worth practicing.
The goal isn't to talk like Trump. The goal is to understand why his communication works on a structural level and borrow the pieces that serve you. In the doses that fit your context.
I think there's a broader point here about what's happening to communication culture more generally. We're swimming in sanitized, AI-smoothed, corporate-approved language. Everything sounds like it was written by a committee that was afraid of being quoted.
The brand safety voice. No edges, no personality, no risk. I get emails now that I'm pretty sure were drafted by an AI, reviewed by legal, and then run through another AI to make them sound warmer. They end up in this uncanny valley where every sentence is grammatically perfect and completely devoid of human presence.
And in that environment, someone who speaks with genuine confidence and a bit of edge, even a slightly messy edge, stands out enormously. The premium on human-sounding speech is going up, not down.
The counterintuitive takeaway is, as AI makes polite, hedged committee, speak the baseline, the Trump-style moves, declarative framing, repetition, performative certainty, might actually become more valuable, not less. Not because they're new, but because they're unmistakably human.
They signal a person is talking to you right now. And in a world of chatbots and automated everything, that signal is precious.
Let's land this. If we strip the political baggage from these techniques, would we teach them in communication classes?
We absolutely would. In fact, we already do, just under different names. Commanding the room, speaking with authority. The techniques are the same. The branding is just more palatable.
What does our discomfort with Trump's style actually say about us?
I think it reveals our own communication hang-ups. A lot of people were raised to believe that hedging is polite, that certainty is arrogance, that self-promotion is gauche. Those norms serve a purpose in maintaining social harmony. But they also keep people small. They make you sound unsure about things you've earned the right to be sure about.
The trick is not to abandon those norms entirely. It's to be intentional about when you follow them and when you don't.
That's the whole episode in a sentence. Know what the techniques are, know when to deploy them, know when to dial them back. Don't just default to whatever speech pattern you absorbed growing up.
Let's give people the quick recap. 3 things to try. 3 sentence rule, fact, comparison, consequence. Hedge audit, record, transcribe, count, cut by half. Superlative budget, 1 per conversation. Save for what matters.
One thing to remember, confidence and warmth are not opposites. You could be declarative and kind. You can be certain and curious. The best version of these techniques isn't the rally version. It's the version where you sound like someone who knows what they're talking about and is interested in the conversation.
That's the version worth practicing. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In Eritrea, a single 19th century missionary's notebook preserves the only known documentation of a now extinct tonal distinction in the local Tigrinya dialect. 6 tones where modern Tigrinya uses only 2, suggesting the entire region's speech was once dramatically more complex.
I can barely manage 1 before noon.
I have questions about the notebook, but I suspect Hilbert has already moved on.
That's the thing about Hilbert. He drops a linguistic archaeological bombshell and just, I want to know who the missionary was. I want to know what happened to the other tones. Did they just fade out over generations? Did people wake up one day and decide 4 of their tones were unnecessary?
Language evolution is fascinatingly efficient like that. Distinctions that don't carry enough communicative weight just erode over time. It's like the superlative budget in reverse. If everything has a tonal marker, maybe none of them feel special anymore, and the system collapses down to the essentials.
Tigrinya did its own hedge audit over a couple of centuries and cut 4 tones. Impressive commitment to the bit.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you want the full transcript and show notes, head to myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back next week with whatever Daniel throws at us.
Until then, may your hedges be few and your superlatives well spent.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.